and thanks for downloading the Wax Lyrical podcast from Wax On and the Marketing Society. Welcome to another special Business as Unusual episode recorded remotely in our homes. Please join us as we chat about how we can help each other get through this unprecedented situation. I'm Mark Runicus, and in this episode, my Wax On colleague Paul Jacobs and I are joined by Jeff Dodds, Chief Operating Officer of Virgin Media, who shares the unique leadership advice he got from Usain Bolt and how lockdown has changed our lives online. And we're also joined by Emma Scott, Chief Executive of Beano Studios, who tells us how kids, described by marketers these days as Generation Alpha, are thriving in lockdown, and how marketers are really missing out if they're not including Gen A in their strategies today. All that and more is coming up. First up, Virgin Media's Chief Operating Officer Jeff Dodds and I met by Zoom just a few days before those rumours about Virgin's merger with O2 surfaced, so I didn't get a chance to quiz him about them. But we did start talking about our working from home environments, and as Jeff started to describe his surroundings, it soon became a fascinating insight into his management style.
I'm in my office at home, and What I can see directly above you is Tiger Woods signed red Sunday shirt in a lovely frame. And then I've got a signed Masters flag by Ernie Els, who I had the privilege of working with when I was at Callaway. And I have a signed a Bay Hill flag by Arnold Palmer, the King, who passed away back in 2016, but one of my childhood heroes. And then I've got a pair of Mo Farah's signed shoes and a pair of Usain Bolt signed shoes, two people we work with very closely at Virgin Media. And funny enough, I was on the phone to Mo yesterday, so people who I consider to be friends of mine. A pair of Lennox Lewis's boxing gloves, which I did some work with Lennox, which he graciously gave me. But I think the one that stands out to me is there's a windmill, which you probably can see if I go like that.
Oh, I can see it now, yes. Red, white and blue windmill.
That's right. And there's a relevance to that. So when I left Virgin the first time I worked there, when we sold the business to Liberty, I went to be the CEO of a company in the Netherlands called Tele2. And before I'd left, Virgin Media, and we still have it today, actually, but we constructed our strategy so that we could communicate it more clearly to our team in the form of a rocket. And what that would mean is, so if I described our strategy to you today, I would say our destination is to be the most recommended brand. That's the planet. That's where we're headed by our people and our customers. At the bottom of our rocket, we have three thrusters. They're our core strategic assets, the things that get us off the ground. And that's our people, our brand, and our network. And then you've got in the middle our boosters. And our boosters effectively are the shorter-term strategy. So they're the direction of the things that direct us. And we will have things within that, programs of strategy within the business, like Good to Great is a program we have across the consumer business, network expansion because we're building out more homes across the UK. So they're the things that are directing us towards our North Star. And I've always found having a framework really useful because there are some people in the business that physically want to see a rocket that shows all those things because that helps them understand it. And there are other people like the CEO that could stand up at a conference and could articulate our strategy, but in their mind, they're really building a rocket because that's how they understand it. And when I went to the Netherlands, we followed the same principle, but because it was the Netherlands, we did it in the form of a windmill. So the windmill has the base of the windmill, which makes up the core strategic assets of that business. And each of the blades of the windmill are effectively the four key priorities that are turning us forward, moving us forwards, creating productivity. And when I left that business, they turned that windmill into a rather lovely model made out of wood, which I have sitting behind me as a good reminder of the importance of just helping people constantly understand what your strategy is.
Jeff, we know the nation has been spending more time online and, of course, watching loads of TV, but what connectivity behaviour changes have surprised you?
I'll give you a couple of statistics, which I think are really interesting. So Wi-Fi has increased about a third since people went into lockdown. Not massively surprising. And obviously, lots more video calling and therefore upstream as well as downstream data grown hugely. One that really surprised me, which, again, when you think about it logically, isn't surprising because everyone's working from home with their work devices. But on our networks, around 50% increase in the number of new devices being registered and used on the Wi-Fi network. Now, that could be people bringing home a work laptop, or it could be they've gone out and bought new devices because they've got children to entertain, or the ones they had were a bit old. But yeah, around 50% more devices. So you're right. The services we're providing have grown hugely over this period.
And people are using the plain old telephone more too, aren't they, Jeff?
One of the interesting things, if you're using a phone, a mobile phone in the house, it may well be a voice over Wi-Fi call. So it might well be using your Wi-Fi rather than using a cellular network. But you're right. A lot of people are, I'd love to say, falling back in love with the telephone. But I think realizing what that small device in the corner of the hallway is there for. And it's lovely to see that people are using those phones, and they're obviously using them to keep in contact with loved ones. So yeah, the plain old telephone's back in fashion. I think that from a telephone point of view, people have got back into the habit of communicating with each other. So I'd like to think, you know, I'm definitely communicating more with my parents than I would be normally. And I'd like to think, I talk to them quite a lot, but I'd like to think I'll continue to talk to them more as we come out of lockdown and get back to what normality ever, whatever that feels like. One of the things I do think will continue, and I'll be interested to see if you agree, but pre-lockdown, I actually thought it was quite, not odd, but unusual to do a video call. Most of my calls were done, even though we use WebEx and things like that, most of my calls were done via the phone if I had to make a call. I think post-lockdown, it will be unusual to not do a video call. So certainly for team meetings where people can't be there physically, you know, we might have thought, oh, I don't want to let anyone dial in on video conference because it's a bit awkward, or it might jar the meeting a little bit. I think it will feel completely natural after the lockdown.
And Jeff, what have you learned about leadership whilst working from home?
Well, there's no question. I think from a flexible working and a remote working point of view, this few months will advance us what would have probably taken 3 to 5 years if we'd have let it go naturally. I think the interesting thing for me from a leadership perspective is, so I don't work from home very often. I'm a bit like you. I get a lot of energy from being around other people. But when I work from home, I'm perfectly productive and I don't have an issue with it. I think from a leadership perspective, one of the big barriers of home working and flex working has always been trust. And it's been, do I trust my workforce to not be sitting in the garden or doing the shopping when I think they need to be working? And of course, during this period, we have no option but to trust the workforce. And I think largely what people have proven is they can be remarkably productive, remarkably efficient. And I think that overcoming that trust barrier has been critical in the last few weeks. And I think home working will be perfectly normal going forwards.
We've talked on the podcast about whether brands should be advertising during the pandemic, and if so, how. And in the last episode, we highlighted your recent ad as a textbook example of a brand doing it right. So congratulations, Jeff. But please tell me how that campaign came about.
Yeah, and there's a long story here, and I'll probably give away something I shouldn't at the start of it. But we actually had a campaign that we were about to shoot, and we were going to shoot it the week before the decisions were taken to go into lockdown. And it was it's a really engaging, really good campaign. But it also includes more mature people in the filming of it, so older people. And clearly, the lady that runs our marketing function, a lady called Celeste Van Dorn, took a decision very early, which was, we don't feel comfortable as things were starting to emerge and the older group being considered more vulnerable. We don't feel comfortable going ahead with the shoot and bringing together a large group of older people. So we took a decision. We weren't going to do it. So we stopped it. I have to say at that point, obviously Celeste had booked a lot of media, and we had a media plan that we were already working with. And she very much took it upon herself to try and capture the kind of sentiment of the nation. And instead of trying to put anything, I mean, no one wants to be sold to during this period. That's the first thing. So we all know that. And the reality is that selling feels very unimportant right now. So trying to attract new customers feels very unimportant. However, what we did feel is that people do, in a time when there's lots of negativity around us, people do want to celebrate this positivity and this spirit of doing the right thing and getting things done as a nation. And I think what we took a really simple view, which was we have the space booked, the media space booked. We want to put something on air. We're not going to put anything air that is, first of all, nothing that's chest beaty, because that feels wholly inappropriate and actually just isn't us. That's not who we are. We don't want to go on air and start telling people all the great things we're doing for customers during this time, because that feels wholly inappropriate. Instead, we just want to kind of swivel the camera lens to look out there, look at the nation, and say, you're doing some amazing stuff right now. And let's just take a moment to celebrate that and dwell on the positives rather than the criticism for this period. And I think Celesta and her team, they were very lucky they went very quickly, because I think if you were starting to do that now, it might feel a little unusual given the length of time that's passed. They went very quickly because they had the media booked and because they felt very strongly they wanted to use it, but to use it for something positive. And because it was quite early in the lockdown period, I think people responded really positively to it. You say textbook, which is nice. I'd love to say that there was, 20 people on Zoom calls or WebEx calls architecting this wonderful response. Instead, it was really one person that said, I just want to capture some of the positive spirit of the nation and play it back to people during a time when it's really difficult. My wife's a really good gauge on this stuff, Mark, and it was interesting that week. We went to bed and we put the news on I'm sure you shouldn't watch telly in bed, but we put the news on as we went to bed, and she very quickly turned it off. And I said, what are you doing? And she said, do you know what? There's so much criticism at the moment for the way things are being dealt with and how we're approaching things and how we could be doing things better. And I'm sure some of it is very valid. I just don't want to hear it anymore. I just want to feel positive and to celebrate some of the positive things that people are doing right now. And I thought at that moment, actually, that's kind of what that small change of advertising campaign did. It kind of reflected how she felt.
This is my COVID-19 vlog.
I've been in isolation for a week now in this shed.
I wanted to make a video to all tell you that I miss all of you.
I think the nature of marketing post-COVID will be different. Maybe not on an enduring basis, but for a period of time, I genuinely feel like in order to puncture the consciousness of people over the coming months and perhaps years, it's going to require a very different approach. It's an approach that's quieter, less shouty, more humility, more value-centric, more respect. I just think it's going to require a different approach. Keep your heart strong.
Well, some very influential marketing commentators have been vocal in their advice that we should continue to spend on advertising during the pandemic. But Jeff, what do you think?
So you very cleverly said advertising. And it depends. So I'm going to broaden advertising into marketing, and I might even broaden that to strengthening relationships, building advocacy. And I think if during this period, first things first, not everybody is in the luxurious position to spend. So if companies are sitting making decisions between laying off workforce or furloughing staff and spend, I'd much rather they were making the right decision and putting the interests of their people first. So I don't think everybody has the luxury of spending their way through this crisis. That's the first thing. I think if you do have the luxury of spending, for me, that doesn't necessarily translate to spending money on advertising. I would broaden that to say, if you want to spend during this period to strengthen the relationship you have with your customers, and therefore you want to spend with your customers to attract more people to your brand because they like what you're doing and they like the relationship you have with your customers, I think that's perfectly legitimate. It's perfectly sensible. I think every pound invested during this period in the right way will pay back much better than when it's a very noisy, very cluttered market. So I support that viewpoint, which is if you can afford to invest during this period on doing the right things to attract new customers in the future, but to look after your existing customers, I fully subscribe to that. I wouldn't necessarily suggest to people they just go out and spend an awful lot more money on advertising, because I'm just not sure what you're advertising at the moment. The brands like, you know, the supermarket brands and the connectivity brands and brands like Amazon don't need to spend more at the moment because they're largely a captive organization. They don't need to attract more people to their services. And there are many, many other businesses, sadly, that just aren't in a position to trade effectively at the moment because they can't, because they're locked down and it's very difficult. So I'm not sure what you'd be spending the money on from an advertising perspective. We took a decision, which was to give people more value during this time because we know they need it. And in making that decision, that was a fairly sizable investment decision to invest in our customers because we know they would value that during this period. You could kind of argue that's a marketing investment. That's an investment in strengthening our relationship with our customers during this time because it's the right thing to do.
You've reassuringly talked about customers quite a lot. And I recently heard outgoing Tesco CEO Dave Lewis use similar language. In fact, he says they don't use the word marketing at all in Tesco, replacing it with the word customer. I'd love to hear more about the marketing culture at Virgin Media.
Yeah, so look, I've long been a campaigner that I think people confuse marketing and advertising. That's the first thing. I think when you, for a large number of people that haven't grown up through the marketing industry, when you talk about marketing, they hear advertising or they read across to advertising. So when you say, you know, I want to invest an extra £1 million on marketing, they think, what, you mean you want to do some more posters? I grew up in a generation when marketing was much broader than that. And actually, I think you could argue that what I consider to be a marketing function or a marketing leader does encompass pricing and proposition development and customer experience and advertising and marketing in that sense. I think a lot of CMOs today and a lot of chief commercial officers today and a lot of chief customer officers today are largely the same thing. So I understand why someone like Dave, an exceptional business leader, would prefer not to talk about marketing if he thinks that creates a vision for people of sell, advertising, you know, just get out there with campaigning, because I think it's much broader than that. And I think all great marketing, all great advertising, all great proposition development, all great pricing strategies start from the same place, which is customers. Whether that's looking after the ones you have or attracting new ones, they all start with customer. So I completely understand why he might think it's better to turn that into customer, not marketing, because it forces people to consider the start point of each of those journeys. We're actually quite similar to that. So we are very similar to that. Our purpose is to build connections that really matter. But actually, our mission, our North Star, kind of where we're all heading in our business, is to become the most recommended company by both our own people and by our customers. And whether you're in my team, whether you're the chief commercial officer or you're the chief marketing officer or you're the chief sales officer or you're the finance director, whoever you are, that's the lens we ask you to make every decision through. Now, we run a business as well. So, you know, it can't be the only lens, but it should be the first lens. So that's what, you know, we ask people to assess the question, if I make this decision, let me think of something more recent. You know, if I make the decision to give away a product or service during this period, is it going to make the people that work here feel prouder about the fact they work here? And is it going to make or encourage the customers who pay for our services to feel that that's a more valuable relationship, that they're more valued by us, and to tell people that fact? Because if it doesn't do those two things, I'm not really sure why we'd bother doing it.
I was lucky enough to work for you for a few years, Jeff, and you are a great leader. I'm sure you don't mind me saying that. And I think the crisis is really separating the good leaders from the not so good. Would you agree?
It's interesting, and I was taught. I actually opened a webinar this week, which Deloitte were hosting, and I talked a little bit about leadership during the current crisis. But I also talked a bit about how the current crisis is amplifying some of the things that I know are important to me in terms of my own leadership. And by the way, that's lovely of you to say it, but I think we've all got a long way to go in terms of being better than we are today. So I wake up every day knowing there's plenty of things I can do better, Mark. But I think I mentioned trust earlier. I think trust is really important. And I think it's never been more important than it is right now. A two-way, I need the organization to do certain things to help me be successful during this period for the business. And equally, they need me to do certain things in order for them to be successful and for them to get through this period and be stronger at the other end of it. So it's very much a two-way trust thing, I think, that's going on. The kind of three traits I picked out when I talked this week about in the current moment, what are the leadership traits or the traits of strong leadership that are really important? And I kind of landed on decisiveness being the first one. Nobody would be interested in working for somebody that's procrastinating during the current climate. You've got to make a decision, make a strong decision, make it quickly. And the other thing I think I would say then is a reassuring style of leadership. Also, I don't think anybody in an organization wants to hear anything at the moment other than we're going to get through this. This is why we're going to get through it. And when we get through it, these are some of the things we'll learn as an organization. Some things we're not going to go back to doing the way we did it before. Some things we're going to keep doing the way we're doing it today. But we're going to be stronger for this. I think reassurance at the moment is incredibly important. And I think, and this is something the government, I think of, maybe they've set themselves up now and it's very difficult to grow back from it. But over-communicating, I think, is quite important at the moment. So, and by that, it's very difficult when you know, government doing a 5 o'clock every day update on corona must be awful for them now, because they must realise, my God, that means every day we've got to find something new and engaging to talk about, which is very tough. But I'm certainly noticing with my team, we're spending more time together talking as a team than we did before the crisis. Now, we all work in the same office and we have plenty of time in meetings together. But when I mean really talking about what we're working on, whether it's the right stuff, what we could do differently, the performance of the business, the impact on our customers, we're spending more quality time discussing that now than we did before, because we've had to create some structure and framework. So I picked out decisiveness, reassurance, and communication as being three key skills. But then I think from a personal point of view, I would also say there's a couple of things I'm a big believer in that I think are more important than ever right now. And the first of which, I'm a big, you know, I've been doing mindfulness for maybe 12 years, 11 years, before it was very popular. And the principles of mindfulness at the moment, I think, are absolutely critical for effective leadership. So the ability to not worry too much about what the world might look like in a year's time, and to not worry and speculate too much on how we got to where we are and whether we should have done anything differently to catch it early. Because unless someone's invented the time machine and I've missed it in the past few months, we can't go and change that. But centering ourselves in the moment with our teams and making the best decisions for today, the right decisions for today, for our customers for today, for our own staff for today, I don't think it's ever been more important. So I think from a leadership point of view, I think for me, this period has really stressed and galvanized the importance of those principles.
I bet working with one of the Virgin brands must have both benefits and challenges. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, the challenges it brings with it is that, you know, everybody has a perspective of the Virgin brand. Almost everyone's had an experience with the Virgin brand, whether that's Virgin Atlantic, Virgin Money, Virgin Active, Virgin Media, Virgin Mobile, whether it's Virgin Cola in the past, whether it's Virgin Holidays, or whether it, you know, whatever it is, most people in the UK have had some level of experience of it. And they genuinely believe we're all part of the same family and we're all run by the same person and we all, you know. So reading across between the brands creates complexity because we all trade in different sectors, different industries with different approaches. So that's complex. But I tell you what's complex but great, and I'll tell you a little story. Many, many moons ago, our business-to-business part of our organization continued to trade under its old name, and it branded itself to Virgin Media Business sometime after the whole business had rebranded. And when it did, customer complaints almost doubled overnight. Now, it was the same business with the same customers. But in the change of the name, their expectations of the quality of the service they would receive went much higher. Now, that makes our life quite complicated, but it also holds you to a very high bar in terms of the product, the service you have to deliver. And sometimes that's difficult, Mark. It's not always easy to meet people's expectations when they're that high. But you know what? I'd much rather be in that situation than the other, which is people have very low expectations and therefore it doesn't force you to drive the organization to be better constantly. But that is the great challenge. You know, people will step off of a Virgin Atlantic flight and Shai Weiss and his team over at Virgin Atlantic do it, you know, very challenging times for them right now, but they do a great job looking after their customers. Then they might go to their Virgin Active gym on, you know, the Hammersmith Road, and they'll have a slightly different experience, but a very Virgin experience. And then they might go home and log on and, you know, start watching the TV with us, Virgin Media. And they'll largely read across between those three brand experiences. And therefore, we have to make sure that we hold ourselves to a very high standard in terms of trying to get it right.
Lots of marketers want to get involved in activism. And with a brand like Virgin, are you able to do that? And if so, what kind of stance, what kind of societal stance do you think Virgin Media should be taking?
Yeah, I'm not sure I like the term activism. So lots of areas. So first of all, I would say Virgin as a group, but also Virgin Media is involved in lots of areas where we think society needs a boost or some help to get to a better position faster. The one that I'm very passionate about, well, so I lead the organization for sustainability. So that's one of the roles I take in addition to my normal role across the business. But also for I was going to say diversity, but I don't mean perhaps in its traditional sense, but all forms of diversity, including cognitive diversity. But the area that I particularly focus on is disability. And as an organization, we took a view some time ago, which is all forms of diversity are critical and absolute, and inclusion absolutely critical and important. But perhaps one area that's more complicated is disability. Disability is so complex in that there's so many different forms of disability, some seen, some unseen, some declared, some not declared. Different individuals perceive themselves to be disabled or not disabled. Organizations are very confused by it and very nervous about the adjustments they may need to make if they try and push more assertively into this space. So we took a view quite early on, which was this is an area we can really champion and activate. So working with Scope, who we have a strong partnership with and have for many years, we set up things like a campaign with Scope called Work With Me, which has an ambition to support 1 million disabled people. We know there's 1 million disabled people in the UK who are able to work, who want to work, but can't find employment. So we set ourselves a challenge with Scope of supporting those 1 million people to get back into the workforce. We did that step up a couple of years ago. That's gone remarkably well. We're founding members of the Valuable 500, which is an organization led by Caroline Casey, who is a disability activist, who's trying to get organizations to put disability onto their boardroom agenda. She has a very strong view, which is if it's not talked about in the boardroom, nothing will ever change. Business has to change this and move it forwards. So disability is certainly an area that, as an organization, we're very passionate about. Diversity and inclusion in its broadest sense, we're very passionate about. Sustainability in its broadest sense, we're very passionate about. But you know what? When I come back to our original purpose, which is where we started this, we're passionate about lots of things. And we can help in lots of areas. But the one area that we can absolutely not just help, but drive society forward in is connectivity. And it's ensuring that the UK is as advanced as it can be in terms of the digital economy. That new roles and new work is created across the UK. One final statistic, and I'm going to get this wrong, Mark, so don't anyone go and check this in great detail, but it's broadly correct, which is, I think, you know, the UK, if you look at where the UK ranks in broadband speed across the world, it kind of languishes down in about 30th place or something, or 35th place or something like that. If Virgin Media were to declare unilateral independence in the UK with just its customers and we set up our own country, I think we would currently rank about third or fourth in terms of average broadband speed across the world. which just shows how important what we have in the UK is to driving the UK digital economy. And one thing is for sure, as we emerge from these challenging this challenging period, that will be more important than it's ever been, not less.
And finally, Jeff, what's the most important leadership lesson you've learned?
The most important leadership lesson I've ever had was from Usain Bolt. And that surprises people because you'd expect me to look at... So I've worked with some great business leaders, by the way. But I remember sitting in Jamaica having dinner with a large group of people, and I was sitting next to Usain and talking to him. And contrary to what you might think, I mean, he, obviously a great showman, but, you know, quite fairly quiet, actually, when he's in a smaller group of people. And I remember asking Usain, kind of all the medals he's won, what's the one he's proudest of? And I expected him to say, oh, you know, when I broke the world record in the world championships in Berlin at 9.58, or, you know, when I won my first Olympic gold medal and whatever. But what he actually said, he started talking about one of his relay medals. And when we got into conversation, it became clear to me that he obviously loves winning individual gold medals. But what he said was, when you win a gold medal and I win the 100 metres, I kind of go back to my apartment and I look, you know, watch YouTube or maybe do some gaming and I'll eat by myself. It's quite a solitary thing, actually, winning a gold medal as an individual athlete. When I win a relay medal, I win it with three of my closest mates. And we get to go out and party together and celebrate the fact that we've done something together. And we then got into quite a deep conversation about how, because they value that so much, that winning as a team, they train to win as a team. They put a lot of effort in. They put as much effort into their relay training as they do their individual training. Now, there are other countries around the world, and I won't mention them, who would much rather value the individual medal, and therefore the relay is a bit of an afterthought, which means they often drop a baton or run out of lane or something goes wrong. But I'm absolutely convinced that one of the reasons that the Jamaicans are so successful in the relay is because they value winning as a team over winning as an individual. So when I look at that, that's a little reminder to me, which is it feels great to win, but it feels much better to win as part of a team.
That was Jeff Dodds, Chief Operating Officer of Virgin Media, talking to me a few days ago. And I'm sure we'll all be watching with interest to see if conversations between Virgin Media's owner, Liberty Global, and O2 progress. It would be a massive deal. I've seen analysts suggesting O2's mobile business is currently worth around $16 billion, which is more or less the same price that BT paid for EE back in 2015. And of course, it would create a really powerful and diverse rival to BT and Sky in the UK. Very interesting. Well, from corporate mega deals to the fascinating world of kids, or Generation Alpha, as they've become known. And last week, Paul and I met up on Zoom with Emma Scott, Chief Executive of Beano Studios. Emma is responsible for the transformation of Beano from an 80-year-old comic in danger of disappearing completely to a thriving and award-winning multi-platform content studio with fans literally all over the world. And Emma's no stranger to business transformation. She launched Freeview here in the UK and then went on to lead the development of Freesat. She was brought in by Beano's owners, DC Thompson, in 2015 to review the business, and in 2016 she introduced Beano Studios, a creative business taking the much-loved characters into television, film and live performances. She also discovered that Beano.com was gathering huge insights from its fans all over the world through regular quizzes. And that insight is now offered as a research omnibus to brands and has, of course, created another business model. Paul and I were fascinated by this amazing pivot, and we asked her what challenges she must have faced along the way.
If you understand the sort of nature of what people want, and I talk about research endlessly because I'm a research fanatic and a planner, what I thought would happen is not what has happened. We assumed that .com would get to a certain size and stay at that, and it's just boomed and has become a big funnel for driving comic subscriptions in a way we didn't quite expect. The reversal of the comic was the biggest surprise. I always said I wasn't there to save the comic, but it's in glorious health now, and it's growing. Only one of two titles for children that are in growth. The rest are all in decline. But I think as well, if you'd asked me 4 years ago, would we have a research agency and a creative agency? Not in a million years would I have thought that. But the what we all know from the digital market is that the money fell out of that in the midst of whilst we were working on .com. We assumed we'd get advertising revenues and partnerships, and that fell away for everybody. So you know you've got this huge audience, but how do you monetize it? And I guess the biggest surprise has really been that we've created a live omnibus, a live panel of children who give us huge amounts of information every week, quite willingly, and all very GDPR compliant. And that's been wonderful because they actually want to tell us what they think as well as us telling them what we think. So, yeah, there have been some cul-de-sacs and there have been some motorways on our journey, but it's been hugely enjoyable as well. And we've been backed by, you know, DC Thompson as if we're a startup. And I'm very grateful for that.
You mentioned the parent company. So how did you manage all of those stakeholders? Because I'm guessing some of them were quite reluctant to move away from what had been their real heartland.
It's a family business, and it's run by, you know, different parts of the family. And they are both a publisher, but they also invest very heavily in startups. And so there is a level of risk appetite you might be surprised around. But most certainly going on the journey of going to digital, you've got to take those decisions within information, and you have to back up your arguments and your business plans. And not all of the things we've done have worked. And you've got to be honest about those. And when you make mistakes or things don't work in the same way, I learned a long time ago when I worked at the BBC and was working on very large projects and launches like Freevee and Freesat, that you've got to take people on that journey and take your boards and your directors on that journey. And I think honesty is always the best policy.
So, Emma, you mentioned the quizzes that are now a really important part of driving this amazing insight database that you have. And I know that Paul has got some questions about what you call Generation Alpha.
So, yes, Generation Alpha. I guess before we go into that, Emma, there's obviously many other generational cohorts for the youth. Maybe start, if we can, just explaining some of those before we go a bit deeper into Gen A.
So not every cohort, like Gen X, Gen Z, are the same amount of time, amount of years, which confused me. But I guess children now, so Gen Alpha are kids born since 2010. In our empire, we have Gen Y kids and Gen Z kids as well. And you've got the sort of millennials above that as well. So Gen Alpha born since 2010, we've been doing in-depth research on them over the last couple of years. But we also have sort of children and teens from the next cohort upwards as well. And there's sort of similarities where there's an overlap, because obviously a one-year-old now is not going to be telling us very much. It's at the top end of Gen Alpha that we know the most about. I think there have been shifts, and the shifts have largely come through parenting and through societal change. So most children now will have millennial parents. My own kids are 13 and 15, and I'm a strong Gen Xer. So my sort of attitudes will obviously have affected my own kids. So the Gen Alpha kids, the oldest of which, and then the next cohort above, are real digital masters. They're confident and knowledgeable. They're really smart about their tech. They've been well taught by schools to control what information they give away, and obviously by their parents as well, but I think schools have played a very big role. Three and four are very confident about using the internet on their own, and 73% question the things they see and read on the internet versus 52% of their parents. So they know what clickbait is. They understand the role of advertising as well very clearly. We've seen that on Beano.com. They will click on things, but only if they feel it's from a trusted source. And they're using that tech with their creativity as well in a very entrepreneurial way. One of the things that really surprised me is that they will make and sell things online. They're quite young, whether that's selling slime, but they're very sort of confident about dragging their parents into their ways to make money. they're very intermaking worlds. Now, that's partly to do with the kind of games that are available, but 3 and 5 make use of their own worlds and games, and 55% enjoy making video. But they're not going to go and paste it in an open YouTube channel. They'll have closed channels. They really understand that they've got to protect their digital footprint. I think one of the other segments that we talk about are kind of new old fashions. Now, this one surprised me as well when we did our big piece of research last year. So they want to return to playing outside, which is a challenge at the moment. And they very much value family time. And that's one of the things we've seen around lockdown that I'll talk about later. And nearly half of Gen Alphas often spend time away from devices, when only a quarter of Gen Z do, so the older teens above them. And I think we're going to carry on seeing that mixed behaviour of wanting to do things like knitting came up and making things. The final aspect of them, which we all know about, but is very true, is that they are activists. They're particularly activists in the home. Their pester power is enormous. They have a great influence over family decisions. And they have a conscience as well, whether it is the school strikes for climate change or about single-use plastic. Gen Alpha kids are very passionate about these causes. And they will question everything, whether it's stereotypes about gender or climate change denial. And we've seen that both from US as well as UK kids. And I think that's really powerful for the future.
I know we're going to go on to talk about brands, but is it fair to say that these generations are going to become consumers a lot earlier than we typically would?
They're consumers already. Yeah. And they're very overlooked consumers, because they get their parents to buy stuff for them and for the family. And you know, we have lots of evidence from our Trendspotter panel, which is our panel of kids we talk to every week about, you know, do you need to put the dishwasher on as much? Can we get an electric car? Those are fairly profound decisions, purchase decisions in the family. And their parents really listen to them about eating less red meat. And they're picking up the information from school, from social media. Some of their sources of information are not necessarily correct, but they are picking up on a lot. Their sources of news is interesting, but it's also concerning. Something Ofcom have looked into. A lot of new sources on TikTok and Instagram, which aren't always true, but they do help sort of drive understanding. Yeah. One of the things I found interesting at the beginning of the year was that there was a lot of trending news about World War III when the issues were happening between Syria and Iraq and Iran. And, you know, that's a cause for concern as well, because nobody's really giving children the kind of the real life understanding of it. But it was extraordinary that so many knew what's going on.
How close or involved do you get with the kind of ethical question of how exposed these kids are to brands and if that is appropriate?
Because one of the big traits is that they question first. They can see fakery very easily. You know, the Pepsi campaign with Kendall Jenner just like went down so badly with kids as well as with adults. They can see when influencers are being used, and they think it's quite amusing. They are way more sophisticated than I certainly gave my kids credit for, but more in general. They're almost like kind of modern hippies who have this great conscience, but are going to be highly discerning about who they place their trust in the future. They're not quick to judge, but they will judge, and then they won't move back from that. I think they're not as persuadable as I would say millennials appear to be.
Undoubtedly, what you guys have and the insight you gain from your quizzes is a huge positive. So have you got any kind of good examples of where a brand has used that insight on Gen A as a positive?
Yeah, one piece of work we did for the United Nations at the back end of the last year, they were doing their 75th anniversary, and they were asking adults what would change the world, what change would you want to see? And then they suddenly dawned on them they hadn't asked any children. So they asked us to both poll our kids on the omnibus, but we also created a video for them, which they were absolutely delighted with. And it was what three things would change the world. And they couldn't get over the very clear focus on sustainability as a core concern for children. And we created a video which was effectively UGC with kids from all over the world talking about what bothered them. And there's lots about littering, lots about animals, lots about single-use plastic. and we didn't lead the children. They very much just recorded what they wanted to. And it's very powerful. And actually, for large global organisations, I think it's going to be interesting to understand how you can harness the power of children and teenagers for good, because they are kind of untouched at that age and they don't have the cynicism that perhaps we all do. And I think we'll see that coming out of lockdown as well. Whilst there hasn't been much about sustainability because of what's going on at the moment, I think it will come back in a very big way. And I think children will be pushing that, because perhaps we might see governments or organisations trying to step back from their requirements because of recession and concerns. And I think they've got a whole bunch of children globally who might hold them to account.
Yeah, so inevitably we're in lockdown. I'd love to hear, Emma, what you're learning about what Gen A are experiencing, how they're thinking, what they're feeling about life in lockdown.
I think for children, it's been quite a different experience. Obviously, they're not at school. They don't have quite the same structures. But as I talked about earlier, because they are digital masters, in a way, we feel they've adapted really very well, those that have access to technology, because it's such a huge part of their life already. We started a live barometer on the site on the 16th of March, and we've been tracking that on a daily basis. So on any given day, we'll have about 220,000 responses of kids putting up emojis about how they feel. When we started, the levels of, I'd say, worriedness and sad were quite high. And then as soon as school shut down, the Friday before the lockdown started, the happiness and the boredom factors started rising very rapidly. So we have happy but very bored children at the moment. That would be the headline from what we've learned. Their uses of technology have changed quite dramatically over the last 6 weeks. So whereas they would use WhatsApp as normal, they've suddenly inherited using Zoom, which was not something that any of us really used before. And that's increased quite a lot, with talking to family and friends via WhatsApp video or FaceTime calls. But Zoom was not known at the beginning of the 16th of March, and now 34% of children are using Zoom on a weekly basis now that we're into April. We've seen things like Netflix Party happening, but it's sort of gone down a little bit. But 82% of all children in the UK that we've polled have used one of these types of video calling in the last 6 weeks. We went at the beginning from kids being very happy that school was going to be shut to now saying they would rather be back at school, 56%. I think being homeschooled is suiting a chunk of children, where I think the sort of rigours of school life make things quite difficult. But there are a good proportion of kids who want to go back to that routine, and who thought that would ever happen, that kids say they want to be back at school. But we've also looked very hard at the downsides to this, and we're seeing obviously articles in the paper already, but it's something we picked up on, about a poverty gap around education, children who don't have access to good broadband, who don't have laptops in the home. And that's a big concern for educators, we know, particularly if we're not really going to see substantial return to school till September. We also know that children who are in very difficult home situations, it's going to be even worse for them at the moment, and we could see more children going into care coming out. And one of the real stark stats that we put out last week was we asked children if they had access to outside space, both in the UK and the US. And 1 million school-aged children in the UK don't have access to an outdoor space and haven't been outside that week. And in the US, it was 8 million children, so 17% of US kids. And then you have to start asking yourself, what is the role of brands as well as governmental organisations in addressing that whilst we're in lockdown? But what are the mental health implications for that for the future if social distancing continues? And what could we do to change that? So it's been very interesting and quite sad, actually, some of the information we get back. And I think there is a role for many organisations and companies to play, because this doesn't seem like it's going to go away very quickly. And the inequalities that come out afterwards will affect these children for the rest of their lives.
How much do you think that this lockdown experience will affect them in the longer term?
It's something that we'll look back on, we hope, with a level of incredulity. But I think for children, these Gen Alphas and the bottom end of Gen Z that we're tracking, the digital mastery will stay with them forever. That, you know, they've got the mastery already, but my goodness, I think we've all gone through the roof in learning about tech going forward. But what will it mean about their expectations of their parents, who are now largely at home with them, and they can see their parents working from home? I certainly know my family, my kids have been slightly astounded at how much I work. I think they thought I just went to work and, I don't know, read comics all day. And that has been a bit of a revelation, but it's also been something where they're getting an extraordinary view into the world of work. And I think that might affect their career choices. I think it may affect what they are and they aren't prepared to do. And if we're entering into a world where we are commuting less and we're not expected to go into the office as much because we've made it work from home, they will expect that and want that too. But what does that mean about the world of work, about connectedness, about how you create things remotely? I think for activists, for the future, I think now's a perfect time for activism to kind of come through, because you've got a bunch of bored kids who know how to use tech. So perhaps as we're sort of seeing week by week, the news agenda is starting to open up more broadly. Perhaps we will start to see Greta Thunberg coming back and the sustainability activism being pushed on. And perhaps if children and teens could be galvanized by brands and around themes, you've got a kind of captive audience to do things. We've got to get through the kind of boredom side of it as well. And how do you manage boredom when you're in a more lockdown world? And are there then opportunities for brands and organizations to create new things which can be done more at home, whilst we try to address some of these inequalities as well?
Looking longer term, what should brands be doing to kind of speak to these guys in a different way?
I think their brand values are very much linked to the areas I talked about earlier about mastery and kind of activism. For me, I'd say their interests are very global. They take a very global view on a small number of aspects of the world. And I think brands need to accept that the social responsibility that these children feel, I don't think is going to go away. And that ability to trust in a brand is very important. So 3 in 4, you know, will campaign about causes they believe in, and 1 in 5 have taken part in a march or a protest already. That will continue, and the range of topics that they will protest about, I think, will get wider. They're also very anti-stereotype. And so how themselves are portrayed by brands and advertisers is very important, something we haven't touched on yet. But 58% of Gen Alpha don't think gender matters at all, versus 33% of their millennial parents. And that is really reinforced in the school system as well, where, you know, gender stereotyping is just not done in mainstream schools now, and gender fluidity as they hit puberty and teens is going to be something we'll see more and more of, but it's not something they expect to see explicitly addressed in advertising, or certainly in the television content on the other side of our business that we create. I think this, part COVID related, but just working in general, what their expectations of the world of work are going to be. So, you know, we already see that with a lot of millennials want to work, you know, more part-time or from home. I think COVID has just rapidly accelerated that for absolutely everybody. But what does that mean for the homes that you live in and the spaces that you've got? Open plan suddenly doesn't work very well when you want to work from home. So what's that going to mean for furniture suppliers and home builders and builders just reorganizing things? Some real practical changes that we'll see coming up. And what's that going to mean for renters versus buyers of homes, and those choices that you make about where your money goes in the future? My children weren't allowed to get a contactless card till they're 13. That's going to change. And cash, I mean, like, we've all stopped using cash now with COVID. But, you know, opening a bank account is really complicated if you're a child. And we all know that you stay with those banks generally for life. But, you know, what about these companies like Revolut or the other more entrepreneurial sort of disruptive organizations? You know, what's that going to mean? Because they're very, the self-censoring word that I use a lot, you know, I think the sort of age of enlightenment needs to come down a little bit. You know, you see 8 and 9 year olds merrily making and selling stuff online, and their parents know they're doing it. Of course they're not doing it, you know, down the back. But I think, what does that mean? Are they going to carry on making stuff? They're going to try and making, I think they will have side jobs. I think they'll have a mainstream job. But I think for those who do create, I think they'll carry on doing that in their spare time. I mean, I know a 12-year-old who creates beats and sells them for £5 a pop. But then where do they put the money and how do they spend that money? Because there's so many restrictions on what they can and can't do. Mm. You know, Amazon, you're not allowed to count till you're 18. I think that's going to change.
So, Emma, you're a single mum. You know everything there is to know about kids. How has it affected your own relationship with your kids?
I think it's given me confidence as a parent, actually, that perhaps I'm not as bad as I thought I was, and that perhaps me understanding broader context of other children when things come up or discussions are held, that I know they're not the only ones going through things or feeling in a certain way. That does not make me a perfect parent in any way whatsoever, but it does mean I can come up with stats and throw them back at the kids when they tell me things aren't fair. I feel very privileged that I've been allowed to learn about children as my children have been growing up, but perhaps they'll be in therapy later on and tell me that it was all the very wrong thing to do.
So having listened to the description of Generation Alpha, I'm really positive. Because as I go into my dotage and they send me to a home for the terminally bewildered homosexuals, I'm looking forward to your Generation Alpha looking after me. Is that fair?
Yes, I think that's very fair. They are very compassionate. They're very considerate. They really care about the world. I think they're having an experience now in lockdown where they really care about people. They can see the value of the NHS in this country. They can see the value of hard work. And they also, because of their self-censorship, because they can see that you can't just carry on spend, and probably because we're going to go into recession now, they're going to have a very different experience in their teens and 20s than certainly I did. And I think there's some hardship ahead for all of us. But I think we've got a real lovely bunch of people coming through. But they are going to exercise their consumerism in quite a different way.
Emma Scott, Chief Executive of Beano Studios. And you can get your own copy of that Generation Alpha research Emma was talking about via a link in the podcast notes. And that's it from us. We'll be back in a few weeks with more business as unusual conversations from the world of advertising and marketing. Meanwhile, please leave us a review on iTunes and don't forget to share this podcast with your friends. See you soon. Bye.